Tēnā koutou katoa. Tēnā koutou, I runga I te kaupapa o te hui nei. Tēnā koe meihana kōrua ko Arohia. Nō reira, huri nō te whare nei. Tēnā tātou katoa. I want to use all my time. So greetings, everyone. And really, what I want to do this afternoon is to come at the notion of capability building by presenting four very quick stories or case studies of what it means to build capability at the moment and the different levels, and then some ideas, I think, about how to think about the challenges of building capability into the future. So four different snapshots, really. And I want to start firstly with my parents and my father, who some of you will know, who basically grew up in Te Tiko with a single mother, parent. He had a Pākehā father who failed my grandmother and failed my father and left town. In other words, abandoned them. At the age of 8, my father was whāngaied to another iwi, another hapū, to milk cows with his cousin. By fortune, his whāngai mother was a nurse who said to him, "You go to school, you go to boarding school, and don't you come back." And that was a message of love. Don't you come back, because if you come back, your life is here on the farm. And when my father met my mother in Ngāti Porou, wanted to get married, my Te Tiko grandmother wrote to my Ngāti Porou grandmother. She didn't agree with the wedding. She thought my father wasn't good enough because he had nothing. Now I want to talk about my husband's parents, because he too had whāngai in his upbringing. Both his parents were whāngaied. One to a set of grandparents, and one to a grand aunt in another iwi in another town. She grew up as the second daughter and ended up nursing her whāngai mother until she died, because the first daughter had sold her whāngai mother's land and moved a long way away from where she lived. So my parents got together and I had a fantastic life. I was well educated. I was well nourished. I was loved. And surprise, surprise, I didn't do too bad at school. My husband on the other side, he too grew up in a single parent home. His dad was a veteran of the Māori Battalion and came home and trained as a carpenter. No one debriefed him from his experiences in the war. So their early childhood was a little bit unstable, a little bit rugged. His training as a carpenter was the making of his life after the war. It gave them the means to build a home and to try and raise a family. But it was impossible. My mother-in-law then became a single mum, raising 5 children, one with a disability. And she was incredible. Those of you who know my mother-in-law, who currently lives in Whanganui. My husband's parents and my parents are in their 80s, and they're both alive. So my grandchildren have the luxury of knowing their grandparents and their great-grandparents. Now, the reason I tell that story in this context is about the intergenerational challenges of building capacity in whānau. And the fact that we need 3, 4, 5 generations to nail it. And even then, I worry about the education of my mokopuna, who are boys. I worry every day and every night when I'm on Facebook. I looked at those figures that Hekia put out today and I worried even more. And one day, the older mokopuna came home with a school report, two PhDs in our family, and a PhD student. We couldn't understand it. And then in frustration, I said, look, I just want him to be happy. I want him to get up in the morning and think, yay, I'm going to school. I want him to skip to school. I want him to skip into the classroom. And I want him to run back home and say what a fantastic day he had. That would be my measure for that age of his success. So there's a quick story of just that intergenerational challenge. All our whānau have those stories. And I think when we look back on the challenges of our grandparents and our great-grandparents, who were also impoverished, who had nothing in a material sense, but who did live in the bosom of their iwi, and who, in one sense, suffered together. They didn't know they were poor. And they were able to go and, you know, get fruit from that garden and raid that vegetable patch. Somehow they feed themselves. So my next quick story is about an internship program I ran at the University of Waikato to place an undergraduate student with one of the 19 iwi that we work with on our Te Rōpū Manukura. The iwi wanted us to put up a program. We got some funding. It was a Rolls-Royce funding program. I had money for staff, I had money for iwi mentors, I had money for every student got $5,000. We had an organisational grant. It was a really good model. And I had to assign two staff, one to find the students and match them to the iwi. So every iwi except one wanted someone who could whakapapa to the iwi. One iwi said, we don't care who you send us, but we want someone who can do a specific skill. I won't take you in the nuances of how do you match a student with their iwi, but I can tell you it's complicated. All right? Not all students who declare an iwi know their iwi. And not all the students who were brought up in the iwi want to spend the summer with them. Okay, so where it worked, it was life-changing for the student. Where it worked, the organisations loved them, looked after them, and helped them do the project that had been co-designed with the iwi. They had a lot of support. And when they came back to give their presentations, you know, they were escorted back by staff from that organisation. And many of them were offered part-time employment while they finished their degrees. Where it didn't work is where the lessons, as you know, are often to be found. So we picked really strong students from across the university. Some iwi wanted a $5,000 student to do a $1 million project. Over Christmas. All right? Some iwi organisations somehow didn't answer the phone. You could ring up at any hour of the day and get a kind of voicemail message. And then when you went to visit them, they pretended they didn't know anything about the program, even though the paperwork was in front of them, and I could see it. And then some were intrigued by, like, they were nervous. What does it mean to have a student? Like, do we have to look after them? Do you want us to feed them? What sort of project should they do? You know, and then they were sort of really nervous. What does it mean to bring a young person into our organisation? where everyone obviously was not young. In fact, they were very, very old and had very, very old habits about doing things. And so they were kind of nervous. And, you know, that little program was a great insight into the varying capability of our iwi organisations, just in terms of accepting a summer internship. At the end of the experience, the students all had to give a seminar presentation in front of all the iwi reps on our Te Rōpū Manukura and the organisations who sent a rep to that presentation. And they produced the most amazing research. You know, one did, pretty much designed a real survey for the iwi. He conducted it himself, got all his mates to go and deliver it, and out of that, they've developed their real strategy. Another one with an engineering degree started work on the river claim, and I think he's still, you know, working in a voluntary basis for the iwi. So very powerful experience. And it's not one that we in the university are equipped to provide ourselves. All right, our students have to go out and experience it. We can't teach those in abstract ways. We can't teach them about, you know, when you turn up to this organisation, you better find out where all the really powerful women are in it, and you better learn to address them. Yes, Kōka, can I make you a cup of tea? The sort of social protocols of being with Māori in a Māori organisation, you learn those by doing it, and occasionally it comes with some quite strong and direct words. Words that we as teachers are not allowed to use. So my third quick example does take me back to 1984, and I was alive. And my undergraduate students often sort of ask, like, Whaia, were you alive when Kohanga started? And that's actually the point. Young people now at university, their reality, there was always a kohanga, there was always a kura, there was always the provision of real. So, you know, 1984, yes, we've created a generation who are very interesting young people, very skilled, bilingual. I wouldn't say both languages are equally strong in terms of their literary skills, but they definitely have the oral part of it down pat. They can stand on their feet, they can switch languages, they can function in both languages really well. So what did we learn from 1984? Okay, there was the Hui Taumata, but in 1984 was also a very important Māori Education Development Conference at Tūranga Waiwai Marae, hosted by the Māori Council and convened by Rangi Walker. Prior to that was a PPTA Māori Education Conference at Wāhi Marae in Huntly. And after that conference, a key educator, Erana Coulter, died. And so 1984 was kind of pivotal in the field of education because something quite important happened at that conference. And I would call it two things technically. One is what's called a legitimation crisis. All right, and the legitimation crisis was over school certificate. And the, I guess, release of evidence at the bias, the race, you know, the sort of racial cultural bias in school certificate that disadvantaged Māori. And people were outraged. Everyone kind of implicitly knew that there was something wrong with the story of, well, you got a 50-50 chance of getting school C. because in a lot of our communities, hello, not even 50% got school C, more like 100 didn't. You know, there was something not right, and the researchers had done the work to show how statistically skewed the assessment of school C was. And that was enough to, you know, what some people call tip the legitimacy of the system, along with, you know, some other things also important. But the other thing that happened in 1984 at the conference is these new troublemakers turned up from the Kohanga Reo. They were the, like, new people on the block. And they were women. And they were noisy. And they were driven by this kaupapa about the reo. And here they were in an education conference. And it unsettled the status quo. And so those two things together, I think, caused this kind of moment that became really powerful in starting to drive many of what we know as the educational initiatives, not only the sort of strengthening of kohanga reo, but the emergence of kura kaupapa Māori definitely came out of that conference. So we learned a number of, we've learned some things over the last 30 years in education. Really, it's about the challenge of implementing change. We've had 30 years of giving it a go, and there's some really important lessons in that. So, firstly, we had to move from activism to implementation. Now, your best activists aren't necessarily your most organised people. They're not your best implementers of a program that's going to start every morning, every day, Monday to Friday, and it's going to be sustained until Friday afternoon. Activists aren't wired that way. You need a different set of skills. People who can make a program work and who can build it up. We were driven in those days by kaupapa, vision, aspiration, hope, energy, belief. We didn't like the government. We thought we could do it better. And we had enough confidence to try and do that. No one told us it was impossible. No one told us it was going to be hard, but, you know, as young parents, we thought, we can do it. All four of us. And in some kura, all 10 of them. And in other kura, all 6.5. You know, that's what I love about Māori, is we think five people can build a system, can build an infrastructure, and off we go. So I'm not sort of surprised when 30 years down the track we look at some of these institutions like kohanga and kura and think, gee, they're a bit quirky. You know, their governance is a little bit... Where did that come from? What's going on with their professional development? Oop, none. What resources have they developed? Oh, my God, the same ones? They're still writing their own resources? What's going on? A 30-year cycle is a generation, and it ought to be reviewed. But these are kind of powerful new institutions that came out of 1984, or that era of 1984. And, you know, there's some lessons in there about leadership. There's some lessons in there about service. There's some lessons in there about, you know, gnarly people create gnarly organisations. All right? If you've, you know, if you're kind of limping and wounded and traumatised, What kind of organisation are you going to create? I mean, let's be real about that. They're not designed perfectly and they need to be able to develop themselves. So some of the critical skills that are needed in that are actually, it's not that you have an absence of skills, it's that you have an absence of imagination, or you have a closed mind, or you don't want to try things, or it unleashes control freaks in the whānau that you didn't know were there until they got hold of the resources and the key to the door, and then suddenly there are rules. And then the state imposes rules. We had a big argument in Auckland around with the Department of Education over the size of the toilets. And, you know, this is when someone like me thinks, you know, I'm way too well educated to be talking about the size of the toilets with someone from the Ministry of Education, that we're meant to have a boys' toilet and a girls' toilet and teachers' toilets, women's toilets, men's toilets. We just come out of a whānau. We all go to the same toilet. And you want us to build four? We only got one classroom and we've got to have four different toilet rooms. It gets down to that when it comes to implementing this vision. You start arguing over toilets, toilet paper. And then whānau. Very powerful word. We all think everyone in the room has the same understanding of whānau. So we sit around, we have our whānau hui. Next minute, someone jumps up and we're thinking, oh, that's not how we behave in our whānau. Where'd they come from? And then we're thinking, well, no, this wasn't what we imagined. Whānau are nice. They don't swear at each other. They make good decisions. They're humble. They speak nicely. They're respectful of our kaumātua. They don't tell them to sit down. We feed each other. We have these values of manaaki. Hello, 2 a.m. in the morning. We're still arguing about whether the school is going to start the next day. And then people like me are stubborn, thinking, well, I didn't do all what I did to sit here and watch you guys over there, you, that whānau over there, destroy it. I'm going to sit here until dawn. To make sure this school opens, because that's what we said we would do. Okay, that's why I'm no longer in the kura movement. I have retired when my daughter said to me one day, I'm just your little experiment. And we kind of had to agree with her. So my fourth story about capability, I got to be the hapū rep for our settlement negotiations for Ngāti Porou. Now my hapū, and some of those from my iwi will give testimony to this, in my hapū I had people who were claiming that we were the preeminent traditional iwi that were there before Ngāti Porou. That we were actually an iwi. So we were kind of participating in the negotiations with our right hand, but we also had our own aspirations with our left hand. I also had people in my hapū who represented an entirely independent government with ministers who came to my hui. I had people who used the word hate more times than I've ever heard in my entire life. And the list of people they hated, organisations they hated, kind of went down this arm and down this arm and down that arm. And I remember my very first hui, and I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? I had two nieces who promised to help. They helped in the kitchen. I was in a hui with these scary people, my aunties and my cousins, and the male cousins, because we're in Ngāti Porou here, they're outside. They're not coming in till the decision's made. They know better. They go, you go for it, cousin, we're here. They start the car. Ready to go. Okay, so I had a real challenge representing my hapū. I loved it. I learned heaps. And one of the first things I had to do straight up is to run a really transparent process where everyone got to sit in a circle and everyone got to get out all the ugly stuff. That took like two big hui. You know, I hate this, I hate this, I hate this, oh, I hate him, I hate him, I hate him, I hate him, I hate her, hate him, oh, I really hate him. And of course, the people that were hating were people I've been brought up to love and to respect, but I had to sit through that. And then, bit by bit, kept running our hui, everyone got to talk, the young got to talk, the old got to talk, and then suddenly my male cousins came in from the outside. They sat around the outside of the wall. And then every now and again, we'd bring out big pieces of paper to brainstorm. And bit by bit, they started to talk about their aspirations. You know, I said, what are the 10 things you want in the settlement? We want our river back. Oh, yeah, okay. Number two, we want our mountains back. We only got half of one. We want the other ones back. So, you know, it just took kind of a long process to get people from a position of being, you know, genuinely feeling aggrieved, using the word hate, being disengaged, having wildly alternative views of reality that I really struggle to understand. And somehow having a whānau hapū talk about who are we, what are we trying to do, what do we want out of this? And what interested me in that process psychologically was the extent to which our reality was so captured by what we'd come to see as the crown and the iwi. And that was the world. And the only way you can act in that world was to react in it or just ignore it. Just get about your life and pretend it didn't exist. And to try and re-engage people, you know, it was a two-year challenge. Yeah, we still have independent ministers of their own government running around. But I felt good at the end of the process that our hapū turned up to vote, they turned up to support, and in the end sort of re-engaged in the process. And I thought, you know, one of the critical things for us at that time was this imbalance between iwi and hapū. And so our hapū felt very disenfranchised and felt that the centre of power had sort of shifted to such an extent that they had no voice and had no participation. And that part of the settlement process had to rebalance that in a way that recognised the power of hapū over our daily lives. It's experienced in whānau, it's experienced in hapū. It's not really the iwi's business, well, from our hapū's perspective, to interfere, is how they saw it, but to facilitate and to support. And don't come down here our valley and tell us what to think. We're capable of thinking ourselves. So go away, iwi. And when we need you, well, then we'll call you. that kind of attitude and that kind of approach. So, you know, those are just four different examples of trying to build capability while also trying to achieve really important outcomes and recognizing all the time that we're working with our incapabilities as much as our capabilities. So quickly, are you giving me a time? Are you going to drag me off the stage? Okay. So just going forward, what does that say? It's really hard to balance, to think about balance, when our development has been so uneven. Right? It's like these gnarly organisations I talk about. And so to me, we have to commit to addressing some of our intra-Māori equity issues. Equity issues around gender, which plays out really differently. If you look at the school data, girls do really well. You look at who leads iwi, girls don't. Simple, kind of strange equation. But, you know, we really need to give serious consideration to the mechanisms that we claim culturally about things like whanaungatanga, manaakitanga, aroha ki te tangata, te taha wahine me te taha tāne. How do those kind of... Because those values are balancing values. They help us balance ourselves as a people. So I think we have to address inequity to get to restore balance. And we know from all the experience around the world is you can address equity by giving men the same opportunities that you give women, and you'll end up with the same outcomes that we have now. In other words, if you have a ship that's listing, you give the same to both sides, you'll end up with a listing ship. Doesn't work. So the other one is how do you proactively target particular groups and ensure that they are able to reach their potential. The second one to think about in terms of capacity, because it's so fundamental, is whānau well-being. So to me, our difference as Māori is not a brand. It's a way of life. And we need to ensure that our next generations flourish within that way of life. Because that way of life is the wellspring of our difference. Comes and it has to be nurtured each generation. It's not something we can take for granted. I do think we have a whānau structure that is mapping to a kind of economic model that very much mirrors the kind of early capitalism. The nuclear family is the perfect family unit for capitalism. Because prior to that in Europe, they didn't really have the kind of nuclear family. They had pretty much what we had. And our whānau are becoming smaller, not just because we're not having lots of babies, but because we've cut off the fourth cousins, we're starting to call that all a hapū, third cousins and second cousins. And that mirrors to me or reflects the kind of where we might be heading in terms of how do you match up the whānau to the economy? And we need to think about, is that really what we're wanting? That we have these smaller whānau. Why is that important? I still teach students who are the first in family. Now, we believe, and a lot of the literature supports us, that, you know, you educate someone all the way through university, they will transform their whānau. But they can't. They transform their family. I mean, we're a little family, and I'm obsessed totally with my grandchildren. I try to help my cousins and I try to help my nieces and nephews, but my energy genuinely goes direct down. And we've got to think of the mechanisms that allow those, that educational capital or social capital to be dispersed across the extended family. It doesn't happen. So, our capabilities. It's very easy to think this is all about getting more lawyers, more accountants, more good governors, more teachers, more this, more that. Actually, the skills that I think we learn from our students on the internship and that we see reflected in the new literature is not about qualifications. It's about a diverse range of skills and virtues and bilingualism. Some expressed in width in terms of the breadth of skills that people have, but also needing depth in particular areas so people can stand on positions of strength. They need social networks. They need to read contexts. They need to be able to communicate. They need to argue. They need to listen critically. They need to know how to engage. They not only need to know how to start relationships, sustain relationships, and close relationships. They need ethics. They need good judgment. So they need technical skills that often come through their profession. But most of the really important skills that they need are generic. And they don't actually get all of them from being in an institution, right? They need a combination of what's in the institution and what they experience in life and in organisations and in iwi. So they need multidisciplinary skills and what's called multi-literacies. We need to see tikanga also as virtues and ethics. Getting up in the morning to go to work is a good virtue. Having that as a habit, knowing that you have to get to work on time, knowing that if someone sets a milestone, I want this due, it's due. You know, I set assignments all the time and then I spend all my time negotiating it. Because young people think it's all negotiable. Well, no, I'm getting on a plane. I need that at 4 o'clock. Hand it in. They need to know our mātauranga, not as, you know, specific content knowledge, but as a way of knowing and a way of interacting what is knowing. So I want to stop there because I know I've got a panel, but I guess all the literature about workforce planning and that suggests to us it doesn't really work. It's not about thinking we need so many doctors, so many teachers in that. What we need are well-educated whānau who have the ethics, the tikanga, the virtues, the aptitude to get out there and explore the world. And I've just got sort of one more comment that I want to make. So sometimes we talk about resiliency. You know, so to me, resiliency is an instinct of survival. But innovation is an instinct of hope. And really we want to move both our whānau and our communities to spaces where being innovative is just like way cool and you can do that every day and it's a mindset. It's a way of believing that you can control ideas, that you can create something. Because when you're struggling, your creative power is stripped of you. You're just trying to live. And the fact that you do is a mark of your resiliency. And we need to do more than live. We need to thrive. Kia ora.